The Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste. But what makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this coffee to you anywhere in the U.S. and Canada within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. No, it's completely flexible and customizable. All the convenience with none of the commitment. And because you're a top 100 listener, Sparkplug is giving you 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Coffee goes good with steak and fries. Goes good with carrots. Goes good with rockets.
I was going to make a joke about how
great with dice.
Our drug dealer is Sparkplug. Much less violent than the drug dealers in the Rio favelas.
It doesn't really go that well with Zays, though.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hola and obrigado for taking the leap to listen to the 426th Ellis's Analysis here on the Top 100 Project. We've been reviewing classic movies since March 2013, and we've been spoiling them from the very beginning. I'm the hood-slash-hoodlum, who doesn't take nearly enough pictures to say he wants to be a photographer, Rocket Ryan Ellis. And here's the cool guy who wouldn't be too keen to live with no electricity or paved roads, never mind all those casual murders, mi esposa, Bev.
That's me.
Threw in some Portuguese there, double-checked a minute ago to make sure those were the proper words. Not necessarily Spanish words, but Portuguese, and I guess a lot of them cross over. A lot of those European languages do cross over, French, Italian, and so on.
I thought all Brazil was Portuguese-speaking.
Yeah, when you hear hola, though, don't you think it's Spanish?
Oh, right, yeah, they do share words. Much like we share tons of words with the French and the German.
Yeah, right, and Greek. Okay, the coming attractions trivia question for this week's picture. Cidade de Deus, or City of God, the English title. City of God is 23rd, or some days it's 24th, on the IMDb's top 250. Only one other film that's primarily in a language other than English ranked higher than that. Which one?
It's got to be Godfather Part 2, right?
I wouldn't say this primarily. There's more English than Italian.
Life is Beautiful is just below City of God, but that could change from day to day. What movie are you thinking of?
Seven Samurai.
Oh, I missed that.
We covered that more than 5 years ago, by the way. It's in our archives. Of course, The Godfather Part 2 is as well. Also, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly is foreign made, but the actors speak English. So that doesn't really count. And one more thing, you mentioned Life is Beautiful. Also, Parasite are two other noteworthy foreign language films in the top 50 of the IMDb's 250. So despite the fact that's probably more young bro-ish type people, maybe not bro-ish, but the kinds of people that love Usual Suspects and Fight Club.
Young men make up a lot of the voters on IMDb.
Right, that's my point. But they do have a ton of movies you wouldn't expect, including foreign language films.
Did you mention Spirited Away?
That's not higher than this.
No, but it's in the top 50. It's another one that says foreign language.
Although we've always watched that as the English language version, so...
Yes, we do.
We do cheat. When we reviewed that one, we covered the English language version with the girl from The Ring doing the voice. I forget her name right now. All right, Boys in the Favela was shown at many important festivals in 2002 and was released wide by Miramax in January 2003. It was an indie phenomenon and grossed a nice bit of bank for Miramax. But Bev, please remind us what the City of God film is about. With the skinny.
The City of God is a favela, or a slum, of Rio, where the poorest city dwellers eke out an existence, including kids coming of age in the middle of a violent turf war among drug-dealing teens. Our hero, Rocket, is trying to stay alive, find a way out of the ghetto through photography, and lose his virginity. He lives to tell the tale of the kids who didn't get so lucky.
Or, in a nutshell, revenge is a dish best served photographed. And he finally gets his revenge at the end on Zay, because, of course, Zay killed his brother long before, when Zay was still Lil Dice and also a little kid.
Probably the biggest reason why Rocket survives the film is because he doesn't seek vengeance for his brother's death.
Mm-hmm. Or the other nutshell I had is, to quote Clarence Boddicker in Robocop, guns, guns, guns.
Truly, there are so many guns in this movie. It's so funny that this followed Bowling for Columbine on our list of movies we cover. Because this movie makes the states look like pacifists.
When you submitted a list of movies you wanted to cover for this month, some of which we will do later in the year, I didn't realize there'd be a theme, but in some ways there has been. Welcome to the Dollhouse had bullying, and then that's one of the reasons people said that the kids in Bowling for Columbine went crazy and killed people. Well, of course, that's all about guns, and this is so much about guns. And then the last movie we're going to cover this month, Hot Fuzz, next week, of course, has a ton of guns too, but at least that one's funny. Okay, well, the numbers on City of God are extraordinary. There's a lot to report here. The Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 91% of critics liked the movie. 8.3 out of 10 was the average on the strength of 164 reviews and 97% of audiences. It's 38th on BBC Culture's top 100 of the century so far. We've talked about that a little bit when we've covered movies that made that list. I thought maybe it'd be even higher than that, but still 38th is pretty good. It was 144th at the 2003 U.S. box office. Elf was number 7. Kill Bill Volume 2. They've got some things in common, those two movies, Kill Bill and City of God. And Bad Santa was 48th. We've covered all of those from 2003. City of God was nominated for 4 Oscars, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Editing, and Cinematography as well. It lost most of those to Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, and Cinematography went to Master and Commander.
Did Lord of the Rings win an editing Oscar over City of God?
Yeah.
Well. Huge mistake.
And also, Brazil did submit this as their choice, the country's choice for the foreign language Oscar, but it didn't make the top 5. Barbarian Invasions won, and we covered that many years ago in our Canadian special, and it's a good choice, but it's surprising that it didn't even make the top 5. Couldn't have won the foreign language Oscar.
I love Barbarian Invasions, and you have to know that as a Canadian, it hurts me to say this, because it's so rare that Canadian films get represented at the Oscars at all. But there is not a planet where Barbarian Invasions is a better movie than City of God.
Well, you chose this for Month of Bev, our 4th movie. You obviously love it based on that sentence, so tell us why.
It's just an excellent film. It's probably the most artful example of this very particular late 90s, early aughts style. This very fast-paced, hectic documentary style shooting and the lightning-fast, gimmicky editing. Feels a little dated now. Mm-hmm. And also the violence, it hits differently at 44, now that I'm 44, than it did when I was 24, when it came out. But what impresses me most 20 years later is the performances and the authenticity of it. It still is a really powerful work of art.
Robert Altman agrees. I remember he talked about this, I think it's on the making of Shortcuts, I think it is. He and Tim Robbins are sitting down to talk about that movie, and I don't know why it comes up, but he says something about how the last great movie I saw was City of God. And there's an entry on the IMDb about how he thinks it may be the greatest movie he's ever seen. I don't know if he felt that way about it.
Well, something that City of God does that Altman does well, even though you wouldn't on the surface think that City of God shares a lot in common with Robert Altman films, but he always makes films about these huge casts and these disparate stories that take place in the same world but don't even necessarily have a lot to do with one another. And that's really true of City of God, with an enormous number of characters, and yet somehow tells this really beautiful, cohesive story.
I'm surprised how many actors are in this, and of course, most of these people weren't even actors when it started. The only one with any real acting experience before this movie was, okay, here come the names. We're going to butcher names, no doubt, these Portuguese names. But Matthias Nachtergaele, who plays Carrot, he's an experienced actor to some degree, but most of these people weren't. I was even more impressed than ever with the two versions of, well, he's Lil Dice, then he's Lil Zay. And I'm looking it up here. I've got the Wikipedia entry that says all the definitions of their names. And it says on there that Lil Zay, so spelled Z-E with an accent aigu on it, is short for Jose, even though I don't think anyone ever calls him Jose. Maybe the subtitles don't tell us what actually is said in the movie. That could be what it is. But he's Lil Dice as a kid, Lil Zay as an adult. We don't see the Lil Dice version that long, but that kid made more of an impression on me this time than I ever had before, partly because he's so composed compared to the Tender Trio guys. And then when he kills people, and we see later on that he went back in the hotel, and I wondered about that because I haven't seen the movie in many years and thought, what is this whole thing about how they're all dead? Is this supposed to be the Tender Trio pretended they didn't actually hurt anybody, but they did? But no, he went back in afterwards after he made them leave by shooting the gun to think the cops are there and killed everybody. And the real key thing here, one of the reasons why I'm so impressed with the kid's performance, is he's laughing the whole time.
Yeah, he's a bloodthirsty murderer. But he doesn't seem like an over-the-top mustache-twisting villain either. He's still an interesting character study. So like you said, most of these people were not professional actors. They really wanted an authentic feel of life in the favelas. And part of that is the accents and that's where most of the black people in Brazil live, in Rio. And they said there were just not that many black actors to choose from. And in order to be authentic, well, they had to have really dark skin to represent that time and place. So they went in and they had a workshop. They handpicked a bunch of kids that they thought had talent that wanted to do it. And they had a 3-month-long actors workshop where they did mostly improv. And from there, they picked their cast. And a lot of the scenes in the film were improvs, some of them coming from that workshop that they did with the kids. You have to credit them so much, I mean, for so many things, but for working with actors like this, for getting such wonderful performances out of kids.
On location.
On location.
It's not in the city of God, per se.
Unprofessional. Working with people that have no experience with this at all, probably, honestly, haven't even seen a lot of movies in their life, right? If you're living in a place with not a ton of power, chances are you're not going to the movie theater, you're not renting VHSs.
I think most days they don't go very far from their block anyway, regardless. They didn't shoot in the actual City of God slums. The words City of God are often in this movie. Maybe that's not what's actually being said, but the subtitles has that phrase a lot. But they didn't actually shoot in what's known as the City of God. If you look it up on Google Maps, it's there. It's landlocked. It's definitely part of Rio, but it's still there. It's still called that on Google Maps. But they couldn't go in because it'd be too dangerous. The director, Fernando Meirelles, I believe is how you say his name, he went on to do The Constant Gardener that won Rachel Weisz an Oscar. Blindness, a movie that not many people seem to like, but I really love that movie. It was on my top 10 in 2008. Mark Ruffalo, Julianne Moore, Elise Braga. It is Elise, by the way. I did double check this.
And it's Alice. A Canadian co-production, too.
Right.
It was written by Don McKellar.
And that movie is brutal at times, but I was very impressed by it. And then also he did, and I didn't know it was him, I forgot it was him, The Two Enablers, The Two Popes a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
But that got Oscar nominations as well. So he is obviously a good director of actors to get unprofessionals like these kids and men to be so good in this film, so authentic, more importantly, than good. Then to get the nomination and the win for Vice and the two guys in The Two Popes. So he's had a pretty strong career, but hasn't made a ton of movies in that time. He had a co-director on this, though. She was not nominated for an Oscar. I don't know why she wasn't. There have been two people nominated and win Oscars in the past. Jerome Robbins and Robert Wise way back in 1961 for West Side Story did. The Coen brothers did. It was after this. But Katia Lund, who mostly has done documentaries, was a co-director. And I don't know what exactly her role was. Maybe she was the one that was more authentically knowing these people, knowing this situation. I'm not saying Meirelles didn't. I could see him being more the technical guy, although, as I just said, he's obviously very good with actors in other projects.
Well, I looked her up, and it seems like she was very inspired to just work in the favelas. She had worked on a music video with Michael Jackson for They Don't Care About Us. They shot the music video for that in some favelas in Rio. And when she worked there, she just saw all these stories that she wanted to tell. So a lot of the projects that she's worked on since have remained in that world. So I assumed that she probably was the one who was interacting with the kids, who was getting the kids together and doing the workshop stuff. But it's hard to know where the work broke down. Obviously, Meirelles received most of the credit for this film.
I'm guessing it's him that's responsible for the frenetic camera work, because the camera is always moving. Altman does that a lot. Not as frenetic as this, but maybe that's one reason why he liked and respected this movie so much, because his camera is almost always, especially as he got older, subtly moving. And then you mentioned it a few minutes ago, so many cuts. I didn't say what I think of this movie. I did a review for it. I meant to read it again, but I didn't, so I'm going to have to remember what I said about it. I gave it a positive review, but it was also a matter of it's just so much. The technical style might be a little bit too much. It is about 2 hours long, so it's a long time to have a film style like this. And then the fact that it's kids, and then even younger kids, the runts, who are layered through the whole movie, and at the end they basically take over the favela. Maybe because this movie does feel real, probably is in a lot of ways real, it's hard to accept, it's hard to take. The kids, especially, are wielding guns and killing people. And even though I just said a few minutes ago, I was so impressed with the way Douglas Silva, as a kid, is smiling and laughing when he kills people so matter-of-factly. Great performance. But it doesn't make it easy to watch.
Yeah, so the editing, I know I say it in every episode that I am an editor, so this is always a close topic to my heart. And I find this film so interesting to talk about in this respect because it's a big part of what makes it dated, but it also is very skilled and artful. When we were watching all those films from the 70s, when we were going through the AFI list and we were in that chunk of the 70s, Midnight Cowboy, Network, you cannot miss that it's in the 70s. There's something about the innovations that took place there that can just...
Midnight Cowboy is still the 60s.
Okay, you know what I mean. Bonnie and Clyde is probably the beginning
also
of it.
Still the 60s.
No, I know, that's my point. Fine, this was in the aughts, but it's in a style that I always associate with the 90s. This super fast cutting, this gimmicky cutting.
Trainspotting-esque.
Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Yeah. And a lot more films that did it very poorly. And people usually say, oh, this style was inspired by music videos because music videos were so cutty and fast-paced and frenetic. But music videos don't have to tell a cohesive story, visually make you understand the time and place that you're in. So here you have a film that's really fast-paced. There's lots of quick cuts, these montage-y sequences of action, often set to music. The speed will vary, go from like very fast motion. They'll even punctuate things with freeze frames, artificially push in a way that makes you understand that it is the editor pushing it, not the camera. These are things that films, of course, have been experimenting with since the 50s. We talked about the famous freeze frame at the end of 400 Blows. But to have the whole film in this really kinetic music video-ish style, it was an innovation in the 90s. I think it was perfected in the early aughts. This probably is the best example of a film that uses this style. The most artful example. So people credit music videos with this evolution in style, but I really think it's an innovation of technology because it was around the 90s that digital, non-linear editing opened this whole world up. To make a film look like City of God without digital editing would take an unimaginable amount of work. Where the ability to easily try something and undo it, create those freeze frames, those motion effects within minutes instead of hours, so you can do the real trial of error until you get a scene that looks good, creates that effect and that feel, that action that you want, because this is such a fast-paced film, without being a muddy mess, like most music videos are. Now, music videos, some of them I'm sure were cut on flatbeds on film, but a lot of them were just cut tape to tape, reel to reel, which also gives you a lot more flexibility as far as trial and error. Plus, when you're working on something that's 3.5 minutes long, you just have the time to go back and forth and try different things versus a feature film. So when you're combining music and elaborate soundscapes on the fly, all that was less than a decade old. And I think that's why the late 90s, early aughts saw a proliferation of this style, why there were a lot of movies that looked like this, and why we're always going to associate this with that time. There's just an element of creative people playing with a new toy, right?
Also, the lighter and easier to maneuver cameras were a factor in this kind of filmmaking, I guess, too.
Well, they shot on Super 16. They still shot it on film. But Super 16 would make a lighter, easier to maneuver camera. How many films that you can say are frequently listed as one of the greatest films that were ever made were shot on 16mm? That's a pretty short list.
The guy's name, who actually cut the movie, Daniel Rezende? This was his debut as an editor as well, at least as a film editor. Maybe he worked in music videos. I didn't look that up. He worked on City of Men, which was a film and also a series, I believe.
Yeah, I watched it. I saw it back in the day.
We own it because you brought it into the marriage.
It's your step.
Step movie, yes. And he also cut Blindness. Now he's directing. And since we're talking about the technicals, César Chalone was the cameraman, cinematographer. Also shot Constant Gardener, Blindness, and The Two Popes. So worked with Morales a ton of times. And the composer, Ed Cortez, worked on a lot of TV and documentaries. Oh, also, Antonio Pinto, as a credit as a music composer on this, worked on City of Men. And Chris and I just recently covered McFarland. Pinto was one of the composers, or the composer, on that movie. And, of course, it's 185-1. We saw it on Prime, even though we do own the DVD. So I think the movie is just too much, but I have to give it credit for what it is. I guess what I could say, here's a good comparison. Roger Ebert gave Aliens a 3.5-star review, but he didn't like the movie. It wrung him out. I guess I'm in the same place with City of God. I've seen it at least 3 times, probably 4 now. That's probably enough. I don't know if I'll ever watch this movie again.
I liked watching it a lot better 20 years ago. When you're younger, you can just tolerate violence in a different way. I find it way more upsetting than I did back then. Although there are scenes that I think are upsetting to everybody, particularly the scene where one child kills another child because he's compelled to by Lil Zay.
That's Steak and Fry.
Shoots the little boy in the foot. The performance. I don't want to know how they got that performance out of that little boy who's been shot in the foot. I don't want to know how they did it because it is just too real. Also, this really was so fun and exciting back then, whereas now it's a style that's been done to death. So maybe we'll come back in another 20 years and say, oh, wow, this actually was this total masterpiece. And now that I can look at it in a different context where it's not this embarrassing old-fashioned...
You'd say embarrassing.
It's not embarrassing, I shouldn't say that, but it does feel a little like low-rise jeans, something that everybody just thought was so awesome and now roll our eyes about, but maybe in another 20 years it's going to look vintage and cool and we'll just have a different perspective. But like you, I'm not tempted to watch this movie again anytime soon.
Based on what I'm seeing online, people are not agreeing with your point. They still love it.
It is a really good film, but I think there's a context about the time and place it was made.
This also does something we've seen so many films do, and I think around this time, mid-90s at least, we started seeing this so much where you see a small scene, and we come back to it later in the movie. And in this case, it's the chicken running away, guys, and I didn't recognize him because I hadn't seen the movie in so long, so it's the characters from later on. It's the grown-up version of Lil Zay and all his people chasing after it with guns drawn. You're all going to shoot it like you do everything else, and there could be a piece of chicken left for you to cook. But anyway, Rocket gets caught between them and the cops. We saw that earlier at the beginning of the movie, and then that pays off at the very end. But when we see it earlier, it's a flashback to the 60s, because I guess the main storyline is more the 70s or even into the 80s. So Rocket is standing between them in the same position he's standing playing soccer, and then we start learning about the Tender Trio. There's so many characters in this, I had to make sure to write all their names down, and I've got the list of all the characters' names over here on the right on Wikipedia. Shaggy's one of the Tender Trio. He gets shot, I believe, by the cops. And then Lil Dice shoots Goose, who's Rocket's brother. And then Rocket has a gun because Goose gave it to him to put into a box for him. And that's a bit of a Chekhov thing. But it doesn't pay off. The Chekhov thing is, if you introduce a gun in the first act, it has to go off in the last act. Maybe that gun gets shot, I don't recall. But Rocket never shoots the guy he wants to kill for a lot of his life, for revenge. But Rocket's a bit of a wuss. He's not going to do it, obviously. And he does have a chance to, but doesn't do it. I don't blame him. I'm not criticizing him for that. But he does shoot him with a camera later on. His dead body is laying there. And I guess he doesn't reveal Lil Zay was bribing cops, and they were giving him guns, because he took a picture of that, too. But instead, he gives his paper the picture of the dead body, the brutally killed dead body of Lil Zay. I don't think you could put that in the front page of a newspaper in this part of the world, meaning North America. But according to this movie, at least, they did that. Well, this is not an actual story. It is based on reality, but it is based on the book, first and foremost, by Paolo Linz, his 1997 novel. Braulio Montovani, who was nominated for an Oscar, his first movie, later did City of Men. Not many other movies stand out, but he wrote the screenplay. So it doesn't have to be real that there's a picture of this dead guy in the front page of the newspaper, but that's what the movie shows. But he's such a famous part of the City of God, I guess it'd be a huge story. You just think they would maybe distort it. But we talked about that in Starship Troopers, where you don't see some things and people get killed because it gets blurred out or blocked out deliberately. That's the parody that Verhoeven's going for. But other people and things you do see blatantly get eradicated.
Yeah, you don't
see
the cow get killed by the bug, but you see the gory aftermath of the bugs slaughtering all the Mormons in the settlement. Mm. So there's an almost insurmountable number of characters in this movie. And it's a wonder how they make it a cohesive plot at all, but maybe it's because all the characters are part of the soup of this place, and the city itself is the real star of the film. And there's no real one character that we focus on really exclusively. I would say Rocket is a hero. I called him the hero.
He's the main character.
He's really the narrator. He's the main character, and he's the one who gets out. But do you think the film treats his story like it's more important than Lil Zay's story or Knockout Ned's story or Benny and Angelica's story? I feel like all of them feel like these really important characters in the moments that you see them. And something that's really lovely, I think that part of what makes the film work, despite the fact that there's zillions of characters in it, is that these characters will appear in scenes where they're not really related to what's going on. So somebody is graduating from delivery boy to full-blown drug dealer, and he'll be dealing drugs to another character in the film that we see later, but they're just there because they're there, because they would be there, because they all know one another. So everything that's happening to one character or another, even if they're not in the scene, we understand that everything affects everybody else, and that they're all living, breathing cells in the organism that is the city. As far as we know, there's only two characters that make it out of the city alive. One of them is Rocket. The other one, vaguely, is the member of the Tender Trio who decides to join the church. But for the most part, everybody who tries to leave gets killed.
Well, I think unless she got killed, I don't know why she would be. Angelica must have got out because she was supposed to be leaving.
That's
what's the
point.
Next day with
yeah,
Benny? But then Benny's accidentally killed by Blackie, who's one of Carrot's guys. And Carrot didn't know it. Carrot kills him for doing it. But Blackie was trying to kill Zay. But he hit the wrong person when the nightclub was dark. You could have maybe found a better opportunity anyway, dummy, but this is what makes the movie work, I guess. But Angelica, so Alice Braga, was going to leave, and we never see her again after that scene when Benny is shot and killed in the club. She ends up with at least three different guys in this movie. First, she's dating Tiago. Then she's with Rocket for a little while. That's the poster shot, the two of them from behind. And Braga was so beautiful at that point. Not that she's not good-looking now. She's done plenty of work, by the way, because she's also in I Am Legend. I mentioned Blindness already and is a big part of that. But she's the woman that Will Smith meets. So effectively the second lead of that film towards the end of it. But we never see her again, so presumably she left. One thing as well about this whole thing with the lifeblood of the city, it being a character in the movie, no one ever says that. I don't think these guys would think that. That's what you and I are saying in a film sense. But Lil Zay must have some kind of pride in the fact that there are a lot fewer crimes and holdups going on when he takes over. He's a brutal drug boss. At first, he's not a drug boss. He's doing holdups of his own. But there's not as much going on that he was doing when he was younger when he takes over. So in some weird way, his fascist boot-to-your-neck type mentality is better for the city.
Some order is better than no order.
But the runts are the ones who are still pulling off jobs. And then when Zay is killed, and Benny's been dead for a while now, and Rocket leaves, and all these things have changed. Ned's been killed by one of the kids because Ned had killed his father in one of the bank holdups. That's funny, too, because Ned goes from no killing, not that long after, at least in the movie's chronology, to a lot of killing, and Ned does some of it himself. But when those kids take over, they're saying they're going to go after people. They almost have a death list, if you want to call it that. And just like when Lil Dice was a kid, they didn't have a conscience at all. Benny seemed to have a conscience. Obviously, Rocket does. I said in your intro that you're a cool guy, because at least the subtitles, maybe that's not what he's saying in Portuguese, but in the subtitles, he's always saying, I can't rob him. He's a cool guy. I can't rob that guy. He's a cool guy. So Rocket has a lot of morals, too. And also, he just doesn't want to do it. That's what it really comes down to. And good for him. He has a crappy job. He loses pretty fast at the grocery store, I guess. And then he ends up working with the paper by being a photographer until he gets an actual job. But what about the runts in this movie? Because so much of the storyline, they're a part of it. If you want to call the main characters as kids their own version of runts, but they're not really doing some of the same things we see the later version of runts doing. And at the very end, that one little kid especially who loses his shoe and he goes back to get it, apparently that was a mistake. And Morales just liked the idea and was a focus on the kid as well. He's closer to the camera for a minute. That kid is even younger than all the rest of them are, and they're all young. And that leads me to what happens next. Well, the killers keep getting younger and younger until newborns alternate between sucking on pacifiers and filling their enemies with lead. Goo goo bang.
You could think it's hard to believe, but there's this famous documentary that I can't remember the name of right now about Romanian orphans loosed on the street because of really bad public policy. Abortion and birth control was outlawed, and then it just made for this scourge of unwanted children and very young children living on the streets. They weren't necessarily running around murdering people, but there was a lack of civilization that was shocking. That would make me completely believe that under slightly different circumstances, they would all have guns in their hands and they would be taking each other out. Let's face it, kids, not the most moral creatures in the universe.
If there's no guiding light for them, then they're probably going to do whatever they want.
They don't have empathy. That's just a fact. So if there's no rules and no incentive for them to behave themselves,
then why would they?
Something's really missing in this movie is you barely see any parents. You do see Rocket's dad, I think, at some point, but it doesn't seem like he has any significant influence on his life or on his brother Goose's life. They're on their own for whatever reason, probably because their parents, if they are still in the picture, just have to work on eking out an existence, making sure that they have somewhere to eat and sleep.
Well, Knockout Ned, played by Sue Jorge, Zay has an enemy of him and doesn't really die because of Knockout Ned, but indirectly because of the war they have. I guess he does die because of him. And that's only because he's jealous that Knockout Ned's lady didn't want to sleep with him or even just dance with Zay. So then he rapes her, which is handled well enough. You know what's happening, but they don't ever really show it the way some movies have blatantly shown. It's not straw dogs.
Knockout Ned's face.
Yeah.
Because
sorry to say this about her, but she's a character we don't really know anything about. It does matter more how he reacts to it, because that's where the second half of the movie goes. He's fine. Sue Jorge is good in this movie. But I think you lose so much when you kill Benny and then you don't have Angelica anymore. Because it seems like she's going to be such an important threat to the whole film, and she does not. And Benny is Zay's yin. The sober yin to my raging yang, as Mr. Burns would say about Smithers. It's almost incredible that Zay isn't even worse than he is when he loses Benny as his, well, moral, but sort of moral compass. So I think part of the problem, too, for me is the second half of the movie, I like what they do. It's still kinetic and all that stuff, and Knockout Ned's a good character. But you lose characters I wanted to see more of, and you gain this whole turf war thing. Again, the hypocrisy is fine, the whole don't kill people, but then not that long after, Ned himself is just going ahead and killing whoever he needs to get money so they can buy more guns, so he can get revenge on somebody, which is what Rocket's thinking about doing for what is obviously many years, but never does do it, and he's the one that survives. But Ned is killed as well, not even by Zay or by Zay's guys, but by a kid who wants revenge for what happened to his dad in the bank when Ned killed him.
There is a point where the film starts to feel like The Walking Dead, where so many of the characters that you've gotten to know are now dead that it takes away any of the shock value of these characters getting killed, and it just leaves you with very few people to care about. And yeah, probably the third act is the weakest, and I always have mixed feelings about the stuff with Rocket outside of the favela. So when he's at the newspaper, it's strange to me that he seems to fit in just fine there and doesn't have any struggles with culturally fitting in with the rest of Rio when he is in such a drastically different living situation. There should be just little things that make it hard for him to carry on in that world, but they don't address it at all. There's the scene where he's in the apartment of his coworker.
Gets laid.
And he gets laid. And she says something to him about how, oh, you've probably never had a hot shower before. Which I read was the two actors having a conversation because that actor was from the favela and probably had never had a hot shower before.
And so they're off camera when they say it.
And they're off camera when they say it. That it's just her conversing with him, being like, oh, hey, this is probably a first for you. So she understands and acknowledges that he is from this really drastically different part of the city, but it doesn't seem to cause conflict. But maybe that was just a part of the story they didn't want to focus on. They're like, listen, he makes it. He figures it out. That's just not what we want to talk about. We're talking about the city of God.
Mm. And his name is Wilson Rodriguez, he says at the very end of the movie. So that's how he'll be credited when he takes pictures. He won't be Rocket or even Buscape. And according to Wikipedia, that means firecracker. Which is never subtitled, as I recall. Rocket is, of course, and Buscape. I think they maybe subtitled that, or I just knew that was what his name is supposed to be. But then he's got, what, I guess four names then, if you go by both Portuguese and English, and then his actual name of Wilson Rodriguez. Well, some of the actors in this movie, because they were so new to it, I guess, I don't know if they had agents, took a pittance of upfront money rather than a percentage of the gross. And the movie wasn't exactly some monster hit worldwide, but it did pretty well, so I guess they must have regretted doing that. Alexandre Rodriguez plays Rocket. It was his debut. Only has made about a half dozen movies since. A lot of TV, though, at least. Leandro Firmino does play the older version of Jose, his debut. He made a little more than a half dozen movies since. Also a lot of television. Didn't even want to be an actor. It's the Johnny Depp story. Although I think I've heard since the Johnny Depp thing about Nightmare on Elm Street is not really true, that he wasn't just seen out there. Let's get this guy to audition. I've heard that was what happened there. I don't know if that's actually true, but it does sound like that's what happened here with Firmino. He went to keep a friend company, and I guess they liked the look of him and said, can you act? And what'd they have to lose? If he comes in there and 5 minutes later, he seems terrible, then send him on his way. But he and the younger version of that character are maybe the best things in this movie. Douglas Silva, who plays the younger version, his debut, went on to be in City of Men, and then the City of Men TV series as well. Also, he's in Blindness, but not much else. And I don't know if these guys are related, but Philippe Hugginson and Jonathan Hugginson.
They are related.
Okay, makes sense with a name like that. Philippe is in his debut, just a few movies in total, is in the Children of Men TV series. And he's Benny, the older version of Benny, that distinctive hair, the glasses and all that. So he really stands out compared to the other kids. If you don't know when you first see the movie who's who, you always know who he is because he looks so different. And Jonathan, who does play Shaggy, one of the Tender Trio guys, was in City of Men and the City of Men TV series. Seu Jorge, playing Ned in his debut, went on to be in The Life Aquatic. He's also been a music composer. And I already mentioned Matthias Nachtergal was in Central Station before this, a Brazilian film. And he's one of the few people that actually had experience. And Braga, we mentioned already, who is so lovely and pretty solid in the small role. You can see why they all want to be with her. We talked about Morales' credits as co-director Katia Lund, the writer Braulio Montabani, the producers Maurizio Andrade Ramos and Andrea Brarada Ribeiro, and there are many other people that produced this film. And I already went through the cinematography, editing, and music credits. Charlone, whatever his name is, Resende, and Cortez, and Pinto that did those jobs.
Cesar Charlone, the cinematographer. I guess I just want to talk about what an exceptionally looking movie this is. The skill of doing documentary style shooting, and especially when you have actors improvising, there's a lot of really beautiful touches where they just seem to always know which character to focus on in one scene or the next, and to always look like you're there in it. It looks like it's easy, but I promise you it's not. And something neat about this film is the way that the color changes. starts off with this really golden...
Sun-bleached
look. But by the end of the film, it's the opposite, where it's this really blue look. The whole favela seems to change as it gets more violent. We see from the perspective of the characters that it looks different to them. It's no longer this warm, vintage, cozy... Not cozy is the wrong
like
word.
Like it or not, it's home.
Right, whereas by the end, it's this much more scary and cold place. And it's nice because you don't notice it when you're watching it, but if you're watching clips individually, like I was, that's where I picked it up. Oh, this is the same apartment building, but it looks completely different because the color temperature has changed so dramatically. And it's the way that you can use color to carry out a theme.
I'm guessing some of that's post-production. Of course, that's so easy to do now. And maybe it was getting to be pretty easy to do in the early 2000s, but it's very easy to do that kind of thing post. Well, I'm sure it's not easy, but technically you can make a movie look however you want to. Cinematographers are talented people beyond belief, but they don't have to be so great like they did back in the day. And they did post-production work with color anyway. There was probably a consistency on set, but there didn't really have to be because they could have done stuff when they got to
You could just, yeah, shoot it all with one color temperature and then affect it in post-production. That is easier now, but at the same time, I feel like cinematographers have it harder in other ways because while they can change so many things in post, they also have to shoot with post in mind when it comes to the fact that special effects are everything all the time. Not this film necessarily, but most film TV productions have so many special effects in it, and that's its own special skill when you're trying to shoot a film. So one thing gets easier and then something else gets harder.
I think a lot of shoots generally, this kind of movie especially, are also... maybe not rushed, but fast.
Oh,
they're working
yeah.
quickly, probably long days, inexperienced actors. I'm sure, I didn't read this online, but there's probably elements of these guys not hitting their marks properly. And I didn't look that closely, but maybe some of the camera shots would have been even better if they had experienced actors. So that's an element with Morales early on. You'd have to worry about these guys knowing the basics of acting. We never really think about that. It's not just knowing your lines. It's not just not looking at the camera. It's not just looking at your co-star, feeding off of them, not just waiting for your cue, but actually, as De Niro and everyone else always says, acting is listening. To hear what they're actually saying. But it's even technical things like hitting your mark.
I've heard over and over in different directors' commentaries and stuff, their favorite kind of actors to work with are people who've done real grind TV, even like soap operas. Something where you just have to be a pro on set because the crew relies on you to just keep things moving. There's no second takes. You're working with a soap actor and they're going to hit their mark every single time. They're going to reach for the straw, put it in their mouth and take a sip of their drink exactly the same way with every single take. They're trained to do that and that's part of their performance. And it makes everyone's life so much easier when they have that level of professionalism but also discipline. And I'm sure there was none of it in this film. Another reason to praise the editing, because I'll tell you, when you're working with this kind of source footage as an editor, sometimes it can be next to impossible to make a scene that looks visually cohesive because the actors are just all over the place, or because the camera had to do this or that. You just don't have the coverage that you needed.
So I've been saying through the podcast that I think it's just too much, especially when it's kids wielding guns and so casually. Probably true to life, but do you feel like the film's exploitative?
There are activists for the poor in Brazil who hate this film. They say it's done a lot to stigmatize people from the favelas. So that if you live in Rio and you saw this film and you didn't know very much about the people who live there, you would suddenly assume that they're all bloodthirsty.
You're going nowhere near them then.
Exactly. You're terrified of them and you think they're irredeemable psychopaths.
This is like the ghetto in Training Day. The white cops won't go into where he is towards the end of that movie. I think he even says that, or somebody says that in that movie, because they don't want to not come out alive, and they feel like they won't.
Well, people have made a lot of accusations of the same kind about a lot of the movies that came out in the early 90s about gang life in Black America and L.A. and New York.
Boys in the Hood. I said Boys in the Favela earlier.
Yeah, great example of a movie that created a lot of stereotypes that were harmful to the community, and that definitely was true about this as well. But I also like that it doesn't really fall into those same Hollywood traps of films about the poor. It's told from their perspective. There isn't some white savior-style hero coming to rescue them. They feel like real, fleshed-out characters with really relatable hopes and dreams and concerns. And the kids seem like kids, too. They didn't cast people in their mid-20s to play teenagers. Really appreciate that they still have this clumsy gullibility and innocence. And even though they're doing very grown-up violence, there's this childlike way about them. They haven't been artificially aged up. So instead, it kind of feels like they're kids play acting at being these big grown-up street toughs. And the way that every kid does. But in this situation, they have to be adults, but they don't have any of the tools or skills to do it. So somebody puts a gun in their hand and here you go.
Also, with Boys in the Hood and with this movie, you can't accuse the directors of being posers. It isn't white people. A lot of white people have made movies about black people, in America at least, and some have been very good films. But in Boys in the Hood, it's a young black man who made this movie about an area that I think he knew pretty well, South Central L.A., and here you've got a Brazilian. No, he's not from the City of God or any of the slums, I don't believe, Morales, but he is from Brazil, and I believe even Rio, so he knows what he's talking about.
And they made a real effort to make it authentic, especially with the casting.
The biggest thing about this movie is authenticity.
I've never even been to Brazil, forget one of the favelas, so I could be totally talking my ass.
Okay, feeling authentic.
They feel like such real people that it seems like an incredibly human movie to me.
Okay, well then, last thoughts on Cidade de Deus, City of God.
Well, I may not like it as much as I used to, but I still respect it so much, and I still can acknowledge that it is a contemporary classic film.
Well, Black Lives Matter, as we know. Black Lives Matter 2 is what it should have been. But in the City of God, no lives seem to matter. By the way, the scene where Benny is killed, not long before that, Zay was bullying somebody. And of course, I don't know if it's supposed to be the same night, but I don't think it is. But he does rape Ned's girl, so not that he was ever innocent. But there's also an important moment where the look on Lil Zay's face is, oh, but I wanted to dance with you. He doesn't overplay it. He's embarrassed. He's playing a human being. But I think it's even in the voiceover that he only ever got women by taking it or by paying for it.
And he's a teenager. Of course he doesn't have the emotional maturity to be able to tolerate a mild rejection. Instead, it escalates into a whole turf war.
But he also brings a lot of things on himself, because one of the reasons he's struggling with that camera is because he was bullying somebody earlier. And I think Benny sees that and thinks, you're showing why I want out of this. No, I'm going to keep that camera. You can't give that to that rocket kid. And that's why Blackie shoots the wrong person. If Zay was just standing around or even dancing, I don't think he hits Benny. He probably hits his target. Anyway, so black lives do matter, not so much in City of God. But the movie is relentless, and I'm sure it's accurate, but it's a lot to handle. I've just never truly lashed on the movie for that reason. But it's a powerful film, and I can see why people think it's a great one. In 7 days, we'll conclude the month of Bev as we again talk about people shooting other people. But at least this time it'll be funny. Hot Fuzz! The coming attractions trivia for Hot Fuzz. Very simple one. Maybe you even know it when I say it. Cate Blanchett has a pretty great cameo in Hot Fuzz. I didn't know it was her until I looked it up later on, or heard later on, years later. But a man who directed her in another movie also has a tiny cameo in Hot Fuzz. Who's that?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune in next week to our podcast about Hot Fuzz. In the meantime, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and/or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that.
Had this movie been American, or could have been on those lists, probably would have been on the second one.
Oh, for sure. It's made an incredible number of lists of the best films of this century, but really just best films ever made. It's a really well-lauded movie. Ryan and I are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Adios, amigos.
And cut.